First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Gender-affirming care for minors is banned in the state of Florida, but what about adult patients? Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, why adults in Florida are speaking out about new restrictions on their health care. What are your questions? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the governor plans to announce he's running for president tonight on Twitter. One important voting block, Hispanics. We'll look at the growth of Hispanics in North Florida. And then also, don't miss a live in-studio performance by virtuoso cellist Dave Egger. That's later. But first this hour, Republican leaders nationwide and here in Florida have been passing a slew of laws banning minors from accessing what's known as gender-affirming care. These laws ignore the guidance of major health authorities, including the American Academy of Pediatrics and the World Health Organization. And now, under a bill the governor signed into law last week, healthcare restrictions are expanding to transgender adults in Florida as well. DeSantis is expected to announce his campaign for the presidency tonight on Twitter. But this morning, we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at what the new Florida law means for adults in this state seeking this care. We're pleased to welcome in studio Leslie Schaefer. She is an adult hormone replacement therapy patient here in Jacksonville. Hi, Leslie.
Hello. How are you?
Good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line, Dr. Jen Coward, a Jacksonville hospitalist. Dr. Coward, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Melissa.
And what are your questions about new laws in Florida restricting care for adults seeking gender transition, hormone replacement therapy, and other modalities of care in this world? We want you to give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook always open. Leslie, let's start with you. You know, when the state legislature passed these laws, they said it was all about protecting kids.
Of course. That's usually the guise that they...
But you're an adult.
I am a 34-year-old adult who has been on hormone replacement therapy for a variety of different health reasons, not simply gender-affirming care, for about 4 years.
Okay. And what prompted you to seek this care out as you turned 30, I guess?
Yes, I was 29 when I began. I began psychotherapy for a number of different reasons. I had known that I was transgender my entire life, but I also suffered from a physical difference from most other cis male seeming people around me. I did not experience puberty normally. Actually had several surgical interventions throughout my life related to my endocrine care. So in addition to seeking hormonal replacement therapy for gender affirmation for psychological health, a physiological aspect came into play. It was discovered through biochemical testing that my body does not produce normal levels of hormones for either sex, as you know, people would have you believe, or either one or the other, but the body is actually much more complex than that. And I'm sure the doctor can shed some light on that. So for a person like me, an intersex person, what this law essentially has done is, because of political rhetoric and ideology, is put an immense restriction on my ability to get care that I literally rely on for my body to function.
You need this care for your emotional and mental health, but also for your physical health. That's what I hear you saying.
Yes, to biologically function. You know, many people think of sex hormones pertaining to sex and think of gender-affirming care and hormone therapy as an almost cosmetic-type procedure. There's a lot of argument about what people think about the psychology of it, but if you look at the physicality of it, a body like mine or the body of a trans woman who is post-op, or, you know, there's a huge genetic diversity to intersex people. Different bodies require different hormonal care, and to sort of put blanket restrictions, as they've done, on APRNs, on nurse practitioners who are widely who prescribe most drugs to most people, not just trans people. Mm. It is a very dangerous precedent. Essentially, what Florida has told me is that they cannot give me, I cannot access care that I need to live every day.
How will the new law specifically prevent you from accessing the care you've been getting for the last several years?
So State Bill 254, as it's been signed by the governor, prevents APRNs or nurse practitioners. It redefines what a physician is as far as prescribing quote-unquote gender-affirming care. So that's a pretty broad term, which includes hormone therapy. So basically, if you have transgender on your chart, regardless of your endocrine health problems, an APRN or a nurse is not going to be able to see you. And so you have to seek an MD or a doctor of osteopath, DO. It's much harder to find one. And especially right now with the thousands of trans people who have been denied care.
There's more competition.
Waiting lists are long.
Longer lists.
Yeah.
I see. So you're on lists now for care. Is that right?
Personally, I was able to reach out to the Mayo Clinic, and I have made contact with a doctor there who luckily was able to hear my concerns and should be able to help me moving forward. But that is an immense luck for me. Like, that is not a situation that most people are in. And that
maybe you had a friend or a contact.
I am lucky enough to have been recommended to a doctor.
I see.
But for a majority of trans people in Florida, they use services almost entirely run by APRNs. For instance, that's where I was using before. It's a practice run almost entirely by nurse practitioners. So,
okay. Yeah. If you're just tuning in, give us a call as we discuss the new Florida law restricting hormone care and other forms of gender affirming care for Florida adults. This is not just kids now. What are your questions? 549-2937. Let's turn now to Dr. Jen Coward, a hospitalist in Jacksonville. Dr. Coward, you know, as I said at the beginning of the show, this law, a series of laws actually passed by the Florida legislature, were touted as protecting children. The feeling that minors should not be able to undergo surgery, for example, or other kinds of gender-affirming care until they were of age and could make the decision to seek this care themselves. So I think it might come as a surprise to some people to hear that adults now in the state, trans adults, are having problems accessing this care. As a clinician, what is your response?
Thank you for that question. I think this chaos and the difficulty that patients like Leslie are describing, this is by design. This was written into the bill that she is referring to. The bill initially was going to ban private insurance plans from covering gender-affirming care for transgender adults. That was actually thankfully removed. And there were a couple other very severe restrictions that were removed. But what we were left with was a bill that created an environment of chaos and uncertainty and restricted care for transgender adults in a way that is not medically necessary. So restricting the consent process as well as the prescription for any gender-affirming care prescriptions to only an MD or DO rather than a nurse practitioner or PA, this is not medically necessary. There's no other procedures that we really regulate in this way. And this very much reminds me, is very reminiscent of what are called TRAP laws, targeted restriction on abortion providers. So these were a slate of laws passed in states across the country in the years leading up to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. These were laws that were passed usually under the guise of improving women's safety, but what they really did was restrict access to abortion in ways that skirted around Roe v. Wade. And so these restrictions we're seeing in Florida with this new consent form and new consent process, and only an MD or DO can actually provide the prescription and has to be physically present and can't be a nurse practitioner. All of these things are not medically necessary. They are targeted specifically to make it harder for providers to provide gender-affirming care and for patients to receive gender-affirming care even as they are adults. And there are criminal penalties attached for providers who run afoul of this law. And that's why you've seen some of the very large providers across the state, like Planned Parenthood and some others, who have said we need to pause in our gender-affirming care provision projects until we have a better understanding of these laws. We have the consent forms in place. We've rejuggled our provider schedules so that we can actually provide care for these patients. I just want to say one last time, none of this is medically necessary. None of this makes patients' lives better or doctors or providers' lives better. This is made to make it more difficult for transgender adults to receive their care in the state of Florida.
549-2937. You know, Dr. Cowart, people of good faith can disagree, I think it's fair to say, about gender-affirming care for minors. Certainly, there are strongly held opinions on both sides of that issue. There are Americans who feel minors need to be given full access to this care, and there are Americans who feel that perhaps it's better to wait till they're of age in case they regret the decision to undergo surgery or other types of modalities to go through gender transition before they're an adult. But I think most Americans of good faith would agree that once you're 18, that you should be able to seek out any type of health care you think will benefit you.
Yeah, I really believe this is, frankly, unconstitutional. This is restricting the right of an adult human being to exercise their bodily autonomy in ways that are evidence-based, that are supported by all major medical associations, including some that you referred to at the beginning of the call. Again, this is not medically necessary. This is not making patients safer. This is the government intruding on the private medical decisions of adults and their clinicians, making the decisions they believe are best for them in accordance to evidence-based studies and guidelines that are well established. We have worse rates of regret for medical procedures for things like knee replacement surgery, spine surgery, than we do for things like gender-affirming surgery. So, you know, adults can make decisions. They can provide informed consent. And once they provide informed consent and their clinicians believe they have a good plan of care that's in line with the guidelines, the government, in my opinion, should not be further regulating this outside of the normal processes for ensuring patient safety.
Certainly, traditionally, we think of the conservative position as less government intervention into people's lives. 549-2937, give us a call. Susan tweets the show, your guest is talking about being intersex. Is intersex a subset of transgender? Is transgender simply defined as not the gender assigned at birth? Leslie, so many people have confusion about trans adults, intersex adults. Can you answer those questions?
Absolutely. I think that's a really interesting question and an important question. So being intersex has to do with how my body was conceived in the womb and how I was born. That is a biological factor. Gender identity is not related to your biological sex. I think that a person like me is a wonderful example of that. Being born not strictly defined by the sexes biologically, and then being sort of raised in a gender role, kind of assumed based on outward characteristics, then learning throughout life why I felt different, or, you know, there was probably a psychological factor there. I probably knew that I felt different because my body was different. But those are all somewhat loosely connected issues. Being intersex is not the same as being transgender. There are many, many intersex people who live their lives every day just the way they are, who've never sought hormone care, who don't even know that they are on the intersex spectrum.
What's the difference?
So being intersex is having a chromosomal disorder, which causes your endocrine system to develop outside of the normal range for either sex. Being transgender has to do with your gender identity. It is the gender that you identify mm-hmm. with, how you live your life every day. So those two things, it can be difficult to wrap your mind around if you are not someone like me, or you don't know anyone like me, but those things are not inextricably linked.
I see. Mm-hmm. And so, Dr. Cowart, these issues are complex. This is a small part of the population. And I think that's why we've seen this group of Americans demonized, because there is a lack of understanding, and it is a small group.
Yeah, absolutely. I was in my medical school training. We all do required rotations in obstetrics, gynecology, pediatrics, and medicine, and was actually witnessed the birth of a baby who was diagnosed with an intersex condition. Actually, I believe had congenital adrenal hyperplasia. And so the baby had female XX chromosomes, but had been exposed to high levels of masculinizing hormones in the womb because of their inability to convert those to feminizing hormones. And so the child had what was called ambiguous genitalia, so that it was difficult to determine just from a simple inspection whether the child was, male or female at birth, and actually required a chromosomal test. Now, this child was going to be treated with hormone therapy to balance the hormones accordingly to what their body was intended to have. But studies on children who have conditions like this, and there are others, have shown that they do fall more frequently on the spectrum of queerness, for lack of a better term. So transgender is maybe more common, homosexuality, bisexuality. There are other expressions of gender and sexuality that may be more common in folks who are exposed to different hormone levels in utero. And there's some other theories as well as to why certain people may become homosexual or bisexual, pansexual. There's many forms of gender expression. A lot of it does have to do with how we are formed, how we are made in the womb, how we are exposed to hormones there. And it does form this kind of, in my opinion, beautiful diversity of human nature, that we are not binary as a species, that there are so many ways of being. There are chromosomal differences, there are hormone differences, there are just differences in how we look and how we are raised. And taking that away, that choice away, putting it into the hands of the government for only this one condition, for being transgender, rather than all conditions, we would not accept that the government could control other types of medical care. No one is up in arms saying that gender-affirming care for cisgender people should be banned. No one is saying we should not be able to have breast enhancement for cisgender women or hormone therapy for women experiencing menopause or testosterone therapy for men experiencing androgen insufficiency. We're not saying we need to have the government interfere to protect us from those treatments, but they're the same treatments that we would just be applying to someone who is transgender. So again, we are the government is interfering in safe, evidence-based medical care in a way that is not making patients safer. And there is deliberate chaos in the way these laws are being applied that's making it difficult for providers to know how to proceed in a way that they can provide care to their patients without being criminally charged. And that's a big deal. No one wants to go to jail for doing their job. So I think,
not to cut you off, but do you think these laws and then other laws restricting abortion and such, we've seen a spate of published reports saying that physicians may not choose to practice in a state like Florida, where there are so many restrictions on these different types of care. What do you think?
I think that's very possible. And there was a news report that just came out in the last day or two, that was a big survey looking at trainees who wish to practice in, I think it was family medicine, and looking at where they were looking to try to get their training and work. And some very large percent, like 76% of these trainees, said they would not choose to have their training and work in places that did restrict abortion and abortion services, abortion training. And this, I think, is going to apply very much to endocrine therapies and gender-affirming care therapies. providers don't want to, you know, risk going to jail just to work.
All right, let's go to some calls. 549-2937. Charles on the West Side. Hi, Charles. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, it's everybody keeps dancing around calling this administration, you know, authoritarian tendencies and fascism. I call it out and out Nazism. You know, they have their new boogeyman now, and that is the trans person that lives next door to you. And, you know, I could conceivably see it even going further than this, to where they're going to start, you know, having watch lists of transgender people, you know. So it's just gotten terrible. That's my comment.
Thank you for that, Charles. Certainly, there has been strong criticism of the DeSantis administration on this kind of front. And let me ask you, Leslie, you know, for conservative Republicans who strongly oppose marriage equality and probably still aren't okay with it. Mm-hmm. The rest of America has moved on from that.
Sure, yeah.
But for those who haven't, is going after the trans community, in your estimation, maybe a backdoor way of expressing anger over just the full range of acceptance of the LGBT community in a way that we hadn't had before?
I think so. I think that there is definitely a factor there. It's a new kind of way to a new outlet,
because it's no longer acceptable to just make anti-gay remarks,
right?
But the trans community is a different.
As the caller just said, we're the new boogeyman. The trans person next door, the person who you've been in publics with 1,000 times, you know, the person who has served you at a restaurant, the person who you're next to in traffic, you know, that's who you're supposed to be afraid of, as Charles just said. We're the sort of new focus for a propaganda machine.
Chris in Clearwater, all the way from Clearwater. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. We're commenting on hormones, and the question is, before making any anatomical decisions, long-lasting decisions, like romantic decisions, to know what kind of a person you're attracted, isn't it important to balance the hormones? And that would include the detoxification. I do accept people for as they are, but I want them to be human, minus the industrial toxins, and don't want to justify what industry is doing to our health in general, which is degrading in so many various ways. So, you know, I've had folks like men who've confessed to having gay thoughts when they've never had them before, and then they can balance their hormones and go back to the way they were. But, you know, if someone is naturally gay, then go right ahead, do whatever you want to do. But, you know, just look out for your health and, you know, prevent hormonally induced cancers as well, like prostate, breast, cervical, endometrial, uterine, all these various kinds of hormonally induced cancers can be prevented with, say, supplements like DIM that's in cruciferous vegetables or pregnenolone.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, like thank you. Daryl in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Great show. Yeah, I just think that this is a attention political thing. I just don't understand attacking the smallest, weakest minority that we have in this state. I mean, we have real problems that the government should be trying to work on or fix, like red tide, either we can't even breathe in the Gulf Coast, or hurricanes, or healthcare, or any one of 100 other problems. But he's focused on attacking what I've been told is 0.5% of the population who are already living a very, very difficult life with all of the health problems they have. I mean, frankly, does he pull butterfly wings off in his spare time? I just get real, get attack the real problems that all of us have to deal with, not attacking this small minority who are already so challenged.
Daryl, I appreciate your opinion. And of course, as I mentioned, the governor is announcing his official run for president tonight on Twitter Spaces. We'll be talking about that more on this platform. as he lays out his priorities in his presidential campaign. But I want to close with you, Dr. Cowart. For people like Leslie, adults who are having trouble accessing care now, what do you recommend they do?
Oh, that's a tough question. And it sounds like Leslie was able to access some networks and find an alternate provider. I think if I were in this boat and I was trying to seek a continuation of my prescription or a new prescription, I would be calling all of the providers that I could find to see who has availability. I would be getting on whatever wait list I could. I would look to my networks to see who is providing this care, who can get me in for my refill, and just trying anything that I could to seek the continuation of my care. None of these decisions are made lightly. Patients are you know, deserving of safe and effective care. So I know there will be challenges. I am hopeful that things will get a little better in the next few weeks as the new consent forms come out and some of these new laws are, you know, the rules are made and things are put into place. But for now, it will be bumpy. So make a lot of phone calls, activate all your support networks, figure out who you can get to help you however you can, and just try to stay in there because your lives are important. We love you and you should stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Jen Cowart and patient Leslie Schaefer, for sharing this information. We appreciate your time.
Of course.
All right, later. Don't miss the live in-studio performance by virtuoso cellist Dave Egger. But up next, as the governor prepares to announce for president, how will Florida's Hispanics vote? And how is their population growing here? That's after this. Announce his run for president tonight on Twitter Spaces. He'll talk about his campaign for president in a conversation, audio only, with the platform's owner, Elon Musk. Now, all of the 2024 candidates for president will be courting a very important vote here in Florida and across the nation, Hispanics. Hispanic growth in North Florida, meantime, is happening fast, but there's more to the numbers than first meets the eye. With more, we welcome back to the show Jorge Bertrand. He leads the St. Johns County Hispanic American Advisory Council. Hey, good morning, Jorge. Good to see you. So Hispanics account for 30% of Florida's population, 20% of the total USA population. As I mentioned, it's a big block of voters in the 2024 campaign. And you've been looking at the numbers here in North Florida. Some interesting data here to share.
Yes, I have a lot of data here. But I would like to, you know, pinpoint some other interesting things about the Hispanic, which also meets the eye also in Florida. It's that newborns, rather than immigration, newborns rather than immigration, is growing this population.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think, oh, you know, the border and stuff. It's newborns, and also driven by the Mexican Americans, which account like for 60% of the Hispanic population.
Uh-huh. Okay? Right.
So yes, Florida population is over 5 million, nearly 30%, and the Hispanic vote decides who sits in Tallahassee.
Absolutely, that's right. It's an important voting block.
It's an important voting vote. As an example, in the first election to which the governor was elected, he got 840,000 votes for Hispanic. That's when he won with 32,000.
When he won his first term.
Correctly,
yeah.
32,000. That was a very close call. 840,000 voted, Republican.
And then in the reelect, how many?
It grew. But there's a little which is done in the topic, but African-American women tend to vote a lot Republican in the state of Florida.
So let me ask you then, you've looked at Hispanic growth in Northeast Florida over the last decade.
Yeah.
What does that show you?
Well, it's growing. Yeah, it's growing due to the effect of same reasons people are moving north from Dade County. The population in Arroyo Duval is over 100,000.
Mm-hmm.
And St. John's County doubled from 10,000 to 20,000.
What's the total population of St. John's County?
Around 100,000.
So it's a big group.
It's a big group. In the case of Duval, it's really strange because in Duval, you have a lot of Puerto Ricans make mostly the population, okay? That's mostly where they're made of. Whilst in St. John's, is a mixture. You have a lot of Colombians, Peruvians. They tend to vote Republican.
Uh-huh.
Surprisingly, Duval, Democrats hitch a little bit more, but there's a huge amount of independence among the Hispanics. And around 47% of all the Hispanics in Duval are registered to vote. But the biggest block is independents.
Interesting.
Isn't it?
MPAs, independents are the key vote for everyone in Florida and in the Hispanic community, too.
I was very surprised when I dig that data.
Yeah.
Wilson and St. John's, they tend to skew Republican, but in Duval, it's independents.
Why do you think that is?
I think my gut feeling is due to the fact of the Puerto Rican population, because we've seen that in Orlando and the famous number 4 corridor.
Mm-hmm.
Puerto Ricans are more tending more to be independent. That's why that area has become purple. They just change.
They go back and forth.
Yes, there's a lot of cross voting.
That swing I-4 corridor. But so would you see then North Florida kind of becoming an annex of the I-4 corridor in terms of electoral matchups? Are we a little bit of an annex of that area now? Is it going that way?
I really don't think so, because you have a lot of Cubans moving on up and
moving up here.
Yes, specifically blue collars. Mm-hmm. If you notice, all the trucking companies are Cuban. Mm-hmm. They're moving up. A lot of restaurants. I mean, the First Coast Chamber of Commerce is growing. I mean,
First Coast Hispanic Chamber.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's double their membership. So, I think it's going to be a little bit of a mixture of everything, and which is going to make it very interesting.
It is an interesting mix, and it's adding so much to the vibrancy of this area.
It is. I have here, they basically live, okay.
And as you look through the data,
yeah,
you also have a little history you wanted to share about Hispanic growth in our area dating from the 1960s through today.
Yeah, 1960s, obviously, you know, Florida, you know, United States was closed for immigration from 1930s to the 60s. It was very difficult to immigrate to the United States. Then you have the Cuban Revolution, and all of a sudden you have Florida with over 400,000 Cubans arriving in less than three years. So
yeah,
all of a sudden, boom, they had to put the 1965 Immigration Act. The original Hispanics are moving into Jacksonville, the Cubans. Construction, lawyers, and they were very influential, extremely mm-hmm. influential. You have the Morales, mm-hmm. you have the Pulidos, you have the Jimenez and the construction.
Pulido, that's my garage. That's where I get my car fixed.
Well, there are doctors there. They were pretty, pretty influential, but plus also a lot of Colombians and other things. 1992, they're the ones who founded the first close Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. It was them, mm-hmm. 1992. Also, which is very interesting, I don't know if you know, 1998, that group made what you call the Mayor's Hispanic American Advisory Board. It meets every month with the mayor. So they were quite influential at that time. That was the charter. They still meet. They meet next door to the office.
Oh, wow. So in short, almost out of time for the break, but this is a growing
Yep.
Population and only expected to continue.
Correct.
Yeah. I hope you're going to come back and talk about these issues once a month now. And so it's going to be
good
to have
you. Yes, I think the Hispanic, you have to be very interesting. We're not a monolithic community. We also we identify ourselves with the country of origin.
That's right. That's important to know, too.
It's very, very important.
Yeah.
You know, when you ask, well, are you Hispanic? No, I'm Colombian. No, I'm Cuban. I'm Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
So that's very, very important. So we don't have like a national identity.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Jorge Bertrani leads the Hispanic American Advisory Council in St. John's County. Thank you, Jorge.
My pleasure.
Well, St. Augustine filmmaker Victor Zumet is out with a new project inspired by his wife, who is dealing with dementia. Zumet is screening his film, Pioneers in Brain Therapy, tonight at Sage Brain Academy in Jacksonville. For more, I spoke with the filmmaker Zumet and Ginny Bullard, director at Sage Brain Academy.
So, tell me about this project.
This project is a passion project. Basically, I've been spending a lot of time. My wife, Stephanie, has dementia. And so for the past year, I've been working on trying to, she's pretty deep into it, but I've been trying to really slow it down and make her life make her life better. And so luckily for me that I stumbled on some people who I think are really real life angels. And two of the women are sitting here with me today, Michelle Sanchez and Ginny Bullard of Sage Brain Academy. And for the past year, we've been coming to the classes, and it's really been, my wife doesn't remember the class from day to day, but, you know, when we walk into this place, she gets a big hug, and I see the smile on her face, and it's just miraculous what happens. And this is for everybody. I mean, so they've inspired me. I've been working with a nutritionist to help Stephanie as well, a woman named Frances Siver, who is just amazing at what she does. And then also as part of this project, a few years ago, I worked with a woman named Dana Merritt, who's a speech pathologist. And I would say that I would equate all of these people, if you remember, like, Helen Keller and that woman, Annie Sullivan, is, you know, the miracle worker. I think that all of these people are miracle workers. And so basically, I just wanted to, I wanted to pay it forward. You know, these people, spending time with them really inspired me. So I wanted to do a project so that more people could meet them, find out about the services. So, I put together 45 minutes of video basically portraying what each one of these, Sage Brain Academy does, what Francis does, work with Stephanie, and what Dana did with a kid who had attention deficit disorder, and she cured him. And so these, they're all changing lives. And so basically my mission is to help other people find them so that their lives can be changed in a positive manner. So
that's great.
This is really, I've done, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So, Ginny, tell us more about Sage Brain Academy.
Sage Brain Academy is a brain fitness center where we educate people about brain health and we help people with early memory loss.
And how do you do that? Tell me more.
Well, we host classes. We're here all during the week, Monday through Friday, and we lead small group classes so that everyone has equal opportunity to participate. And each day we have a different brain health topic. Like today we are discussing building cognitive reserve, for instance. So we'll have different activities that will support that topic. And we also do a lot of intentional movement and what we call bilateral asymmetrical movements, all focused on better brain health, better cognitive function.
And that's of interest to so many people, isn't it? That
Absolutely.
You want to have come out to the film.
Well, as we all know, you know, the people are getting Alzheimer's these days at an increasing rate, which is kind of disturbing. But what we're doing is trying to educate people about ways to help prevent that, to prevent Alzheimer's or memory loss, because there are ways that you can do it. We have a research-based curriculum that focuses on these different modalities that can help people with their cognitive function.
So check that out. Go to sagebrainacademy.com. Here's some more good news for your Wednesday. Jazz Fest coming up this weekend downtown. And more music. A special concert will wrap up the 50th anniversary season at the Beaches Fine Arts Series. In order to celebrate Memorial Day weekend, they'll be playing patriotic pieces like Lift Every Voice, America the Beautiful, Fanfare for the Common Man, and others. This concert features the full symphony orchestra at St. Paul's by the Sea, Friday, 7:30 p.m. And as always, their concerts are free. Check that out. More music and food to tell you about. Palatka's iconic Blue Crab Festival has been bringing family fun to their downtown waterfront for nearly 30 years. This year's festival kicks off Friday and runs through Sunday. Headliners include Molly Hatchet, the Ying Yang Twins, and others. Sunday, May 28th is local day with local artists on the stage. Check out the Palatka Blue Crab Festival this weekend. And shout out to Main Street Food Park. They're hosting their Summer Sun Fun and Safety event Saturday afternoon from 3 to 6 p.m. Vendors will include everyone from JSO to JFRD to talk about home security and fire safety. There will be lots of other things for the kids to do. This is such a fun place to check out. It's the Main Street Food Park at 1352 North Main in the heart of Springfield. And, you know, as always, if you've got any good news you'd like us to add to our weekly Wednesday menu, drop us a line. We get so many emails from all of you out there every week saying, let the public know about this event or this concert or this fundraiser. We get as many of them on as we can each week. Yes, it's our What's Good Wednesdays every Wednesday morning, and you can drop me a line anytime at First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Now, in a moment, don't miss the live in studio performance in just a few minutes as we welcome 5-time Grammy nominee and cello and piano virtuoso Dave Egger. A preview of his show tonight at Friday Musicale. We'll be right back.
Jacksonville Music Experience in Winterland present Japanese psychedelic rock band Acid Mother's Temple. The experimental juggernaut performs for free on the loading docks at the Jesse Ball DuPont Nonprofit Center in downtown Jacksonville on Friday, May 26th, with local support from Madre Vaca and Majestic Mother. Show starts at 6 p.m. More information at jacksmusic.org/events.
I'm Scott Tong. It has been 3 decades since a TV series was shot in Somalia. Now it's happened. Director Ahmed Farah cast local actors to portray real life there.
Some of the scenes, we had actors really crying because it reminds them something. It was so emotional for them.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9. As a celebrity chef, Lydia Bastianich has won James Beard Awards, hosted a long-running TV series, and written many cookbooks. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with her about how she built her career after fleeing the chaos in Europe with her family following World War II. And, of course, we'll talk about Italian food. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
A year after the Robb Elementary shooting, families are finally getting some answers, but not from law enforcement. CNN is sharing new footage of the attack with the parents in Uvalde. We speak to its lead investigative reporter and hear why Texas authorities have kept so many in the dark for so long. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's your chance to see one of the world's best cellists at a unique concert event. Friday Musicale, along with Atypical Arts, present the return of five-time Grammy nominee and cello and piano virtuoso Dave Eger. Eger performs at 7 p.m. tonight at Friday Musicale on Oak Street, along with his band. We've got a preview right now. Dave Eger, welcome to Studio 2. Good morning.
Thanks for having me. It's so great to be back.
It's great to have you, and I think there's so much excitement about your concert tonight at Friday Musicale. Tell us about the show.
Well, we're really excited. We're actually calling the show From the Mountaintop, and the last couple of years I've been living in Tennessee, and I've always had a really powerful relationship to American folk music. Mm-hmm. And throughout the COVID period, I was quarantining with a lot of bluegrassers. So we forged a really exciting way of pulling together classical music, bluegrass, Americana, old time music, and really kind of pulling it into a space that's really unique and special. So we're really excited to bring that to everyone tonight. We have everything from some Bach to Aaron Copland to Doc Watson and Beatles.
Wow. Now, you studied under Aaron Copland and Yo-Yo Ma, and you've performed with some of the biggest names in music. Pretty incredible career.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was funny. We were just talking about it. I grew up down the street from where Aaron Copland retired. So when he was like in his late 80s, I was 6 years old, and I wrote him a little note and put it in his mailbox and said that I should play for him because my mom was the piano teacher. And she said he's like, so I didn't have any idea who he was. I was like, oh, that's like the tall guy who comes to the library concerts.
Oh my gosh.
So I did. Yeah, there's a little children's piece called The Cat and the Mouse that he wrote, and I was playing it already at six. So then in the last couple of years of his life, he died when I was about 8 or 9 years old. I got to study with him, and I really had no idea who he was. Like later when I went to Juilliard, they were like, oh, you studied with Copland. I was like, but you know, to me, he was just this cool man down the street who was lived in this very sparse house and had a lot of ideas, and it was very cool.
That is an incredible story. So you were a child prodigy. Not only are you a virtuoso on the cello, you're also a five-time Grammy nominee with playing on the piano. You've won multiple awards and nominations on two instruments. What do you like? Do you have one that you like better than the other?
I mean, you know, it's funny. It's like music is all storytelling for me. My dad's a writer, and my stepmom, who I really grew up with, is a writer. And I just always feel like it's about narrative to me. That's the thing. So whatever the instrument is, I love the cello because I feel like it's an exciting time for the cello to find a new voice in jazz. And Yo-Yo's definitely opened the way to all these powerful new styles.
Another of your mentors. Okay, so with all of that said, we're so pleased to have Dave perform live in studio. A preview of his show tonight, which is almost sold out, I'm told, at Friday Musicale on Oak Street. Here he is. Dave Eger on the cello.
If it's okay, I'm going to say one thing about what I'm going to play.
Sure.
Said, right? So this is actually from a little excerpt from a record I put out last year called Ourself Behind Ourself Concealed, which was nominated for 2 Grammys this year. And I'm actually going to play a little excerpt of a piece called Black Mountain Calling by Indigenous composer Martha Redbone.
That's Dave Egger tonight with his band at Friday Musicale in, on Oak Street in Riverside. Dave, you're not next to the microphone, so you can just say thank you from afar. That was incredible. Oh, there he is. That was so beautiful. We're so lucky to have you come perform this way. Thank you for joining us, everyone. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.